happy day.
Oh, happy day.
When Jesus wore.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. Today, an original presentation, going off the grid a bit. Not going to follow the normal health, nutrition, environmental issues, social issues, guest feedback, commentary, because of my concern about the impending crisis in Syria. I believe that from the New York Times and Washington Post and the other major media, the talking heads, even in the realm of what would seem to be a more restrained approach to war, you know, the host of MSNBC, are still in alignment. They're not questioning, are the facts known? Do we have all the evidence? Is it possible that the unfortunate death of these innocent civilians was done by the activist, by the instigators, provocateurs, so that would draw us in? Were we aware of this with all of our monitoring of all satellite communication, self-communication, especially in that area of the world? If anyone was speaking about this on the telephone or communicating it, we would know about it. But that doesn't seem to be the major issue. It's what kind of strike and how bad should it be? And so I'm going to spend some time today, not just on this topic, beginning in a few moments with Professor Paul Craig Roberts, one of the most progressive analytical thinkers and commentators on the state of our nation and its government dysfunction and the political corruption and global and domestic economic threats and the war on terror and the decline in human values in American society. He will be the person leading us into this discussion. He is the author of How the Economy Was Lost, The War of the Worlds. But then I will provide historical precedents where we will show you that before we condemn the use of these weapons of mass destruction, which should be condemned, then why do not we first condemn ourselves? Because we have used more weapons of mass destruction, killed more people, injured more people, despoiled more environments than any other group since World War II. And I will give you the details on that. Also, last evening on Rachel Maddow's program, she correctly stated that why haven't we waited till the UN inspectors have a full examination and then give us their feedback? So at least we will have that to determine, was it the Bashir government who was responsible, or was it the other individuals who are fighting against him? Instead, we want to rush into this. Do we have a U.S. mandate to do this? Do we have a full support of Congress to do this? These are the questions that are not being addressed. However, what really concerned me was that she did not use the historical challenge of looking at all the weapons of mass destruction, including chemical and biological weapons that we have employed, that we have given to other countries, including in one case in Iraq. She showed a report that I'll report on in a moment, showing that we were fully aware of Iran's and the Kurdish deaths being due to sarin gas and chemical gas, and we were knowledgeable about it. We were fully aware of it. I had written an article, an investigative reporting article, one of many I did at that time, showing that we actually found how the United States was shipping biological agents, chemical agents, banned agents against all international treaties through our CDC and our Department of Agriculture. We actually had the bills of lading and showed this. But she had on an expert, and what the expert said was so typical of the corporate left that tries to play the I'm independent game. Oh, I've spoken with people today in Washington who assure me that, you know, this is all real. Really? And would this have been one of the so-called independent experts from one of these foundations? None of these foundations are neutral and objective. That would have said in 2003, well, I've spoken with people at the CIA and State Department. We have absolute evidence of the weapons of mass destruction. I would have thought that she would have brought on people such as my guest, Professor Paul Craig Roberts, or Chris Hedges, or any number of individuals who could have challenged this. But that didn't happen. So we have a lot to share today. Then a commentary. I'm going to take you through every single president since FDR, or let's say since starting with Eisenhower, and show you how what they've done to the American public and what policies have been against the interests of the American public, they're never held accountable for because they're all charismatic. In effect, they're all con artists. I believe that all these individuals are actually sociopathic. So I will give insights as well as Professor James Petras from Global Research. Also, to give you a little more emphasis today on how in plain sight we are militarizing the police and becoming a police state, I'll show you some of the most bizarre SWAT team raids. And you would say, well, why in the world would they need a SWAT team? Why would they do that, and why would we tolerate it? I'll give you specific examples, and some of them are just almost unbelievable, but they actually happen, and you will see them. And then, time permitting, I will play you a tape to give you an idea of how close we are to becoming a fascist nation controlled by a police state mentality with militarization at every level, and where that takes us. What is the end game? All of this completely documented, none of it conspiratorial. Let's begin by saying hello to my guest, who is standing by, Professor Paul Craig Roberts. Nice to have you with us today.
Hello, Gary.
First, I'm going to read just a piece of an article of yours, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Okay. This is entitled Syria, Another Western War Crime in the Making, published by paulcraigroberts.org. And it says the following: the war criminals in Washington and other Western capitals are determined to maintain their lie that the Syrian government used chemical weapons. Having failed in efforts to intimidate the UN chemical inspectors in Syria, Washington has demanded that UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon withdraw the chemical weapons inspectors before they can assess the evidence and make their report. The UN Secretary General stood up to the Washington war criminals and rejected their demand. However, as with Iraq, Washington's decision to commit aggression against Syria is not based upon any facts. The U.S. and U.K. governments have revealed none of the conclusive evidence they claim to have that the Syrian government used chemical weapons. Listening to their voices, observing their body language, and looking into their eyes, it is completely obvious that John Kerry and his British and German puppets are lying through their teeth. This is a far more shameful situation than the massive lies that former Secretary of State Colin Powell told the UN about Iraq weapons of mass destruction. Colin Powell claims that he was deceived by the White House and did not know he was lying. Kerry and the British, French, and German puppets know full well they're lying. The face that Washington presents to the world is the brazen face of a liar. Washington's British and French puppet governments are poised to yet again reveal their criminality. The image of the West as war criminal is not a propaganda image created by the West's enemies, but the portrait that the West has painted by itself. The UK Independent reports that over the past week, Obama, Cameron, and and the French president agreed to launch cruise missile attacks against the Syrian government within 2 weeks, despite the lack of any authorization from the UN and despite the absence of any evidence in behalf of Washington's claim that the Syrian government has used chemical weapons against the Washington-backed rebels, largely U.S.-supported external forces seeking to overthrow the Syrian government. And finally, indeed, one reason for the rush to war is to prevent the UN inspection that Washington knows would disprove its claim and possibly implicate Washington in the false flag attack by the rebels who assembled a large number of children into one area to be chemically murdered, with the blame pinned on Washington and the Syrian government. And another reason for the rush to war is that Cameron, the UK Prime Minister, wants to get the war going before the British Parliament can block him from providing cover for Obama's war crimes the way that Tony Blair provided cover for George Bush's, for which Blair was duly rewarded. What does Cameron care about Syrian lives when he can leave office into the waiting arms of a $50 million fortune? And then it goes on from there. Please pick that up and continue with what the latest information you have. We know that innocent civilians have been killed. What we don't know is who did it, and I'm concerned about going in to do any form of attack on Syria until such time that we have hard evidence of who is to blame, and then use the UN to see what sanctions or what effort could be made that does not have to immediately begin with a military strike. Your thoughts, please.
Well, Gary, I think it's completely obvious who did it. This is a false flag event, organized with the complicity of Washington in order to get their war going. This has been obvious since Obama demonized chemical weapons, but not, of course, the nuclear bunker busters that they planned to use against Iran. So he demonized the weapons, and then he says, we have drawn this red line, and if Syria steps over this line and uses weapons, we're going to attack them. Well, now, look, suppose you're a 99-pound weakling and Mike Tyson walks up to you and draws a line on the floor and says, you step across that line, I'm going to waste you. Are you going to step across that line? Of course not. So the whole thing is obvious. It's even more obvious than the Iraqi thing. And they're trying to act before the UN inspectors. You may remember in Iraq, the inspectors reported there were no weapons, but it didn't stop them from claiming there were and having an invasion. The United States has already declared that they don't care what the weapons inspectors find in Syria. They've made up their mind. So we know that. It's all going to happen. The question is, what is the real agenda? That's the question. This is the question no one asks and no one answers. What is the agenda? Why is Washington so intent on these wars? I think I know the answer. The answer is that if you can radicalize the Muslims, you can use them to destabilize both Russia and China. And these are the only two countries that have the power or the wherewithal to withstand and oppose American world hegemony, which is, of course, the agenda of the neoconservatives who control the government. It's the world hegemony of the United States. Well, Russia has large populations of Muslims. It's bordered by a number of Muslim countries. Even China has a Muslim population. So this radicalization that the United States is creating, which a lot of people are puzzled about. Oh, if we are so much against terrorists, why are we creating all these terrorists that they'll come here and get us and so on? But actually, it doesn't work that way. What happens is this radicalization spreads into the Muslim populations in Russia, in China, into those that border them, and they become a method for the U.S. to use to destabilize these two large and somewhat powerful countries. Another method they have is that the United States finances, I think, 1,000 non-government organizations, NGOs, who operate in Russia posing as human rights organizations and the like. In fact, the Russian political opposition is financed by Washington. All of these institutions that are living on American money, it can be used to destabilize the Russian government, particularly once they're confronted with all kinds of rebel terrorism in their own countries. They then will be, the Russian government would be damned for its harsh measures against rebels, just like Assad is being damned for measures against the rebels in Syria. So it's part of a destabilization. It's the way the United States can cause the governments of these two countries to be fragmented. In China, the way we work it, every time an American corporation opens a plant or an American bank opens a branch, they create a Chinese board, a regional board for that company and bank. Of course, it doesn't really have any power. That remains in the home office. But they put on these boards the relatives of the local and regional party officials. So these boards become a way of, they become a conduit for funneling money into the Chinese party, which causes problems with their loyalties and their reliability by the central government. And we do the same thing. We've penetrated, the United States has penetrated Chinese academic life. The universities, the Rockefeller University is very active there, Rockefeller philanthropy. And what they do, they encourage liberalization. And the whole purpose of liberalization is to create dissenting voices that can be arrayed against the Chinese government. Now, what these voices do, they resurrect regional and ethnic differences and undermine the cohesiveness of the national government. So you have a situation where both Russia and China are riven with American fifth columns. And the whole reason for this, these wars to radicalize the Muslims, it ends up isolating China and Russia diplomatically. It's highly risky because both countries are outgunned militarily, and so nuclear weapons become the only guarantor of their sovereignty. And we see already that both Russia and China are upgrading their strategic nuclear forces. So they're beginning to see that there's no such thing in the West as international law. There's no constraint on the criminality of the West, and that they're too far behind in a diplomatic position and in conventional military forces, and that the only option for them is nuclear weapons. So I think that the outcome of this insanity that has its origin in Washington is to drive the world to nuclear war. In fact, I would say we are far closer to nuclear war now than we ever were, even during the most dangerous periods of the Cold War. And so when Washington finishes with Syria, the next target's Iran. And Russia and China will no longer be able to fool themselves about American respect for law or anything of the sort. So I think what the real danger of all this is, it's bringing us very close to nuclear war.
There's someone who believes that this is merely a part of an ongoing agenda. This is General Wesley Clark. Here's what he had to say. This is a short piece.
I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the joint staff who had used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, "No, no." He says, we've made the decision we're going to war with Iraq. This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, we're going to war with Iraq. Why? He said, I don't know. He said, I guess they don't know what else to do. So I said, well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to al-Qaeda? He said, no, no. He says, there's nothing new that way. They've just made the decision to go to war with Iraq. He said, I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments. And he said, I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail. So I came back to see him a few weeks later, and by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, are we still going to war with Iraq? And he said, oh, it's worse than that. He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today, and he said, this is a memo that describes how we're going to take out 7 countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran.
That was Wesley Clark. He is mirroring what you just said.
Yeah, well, this is well known. It's in the neoconservative document that's available online. What is it called? It the program for what is it they call it? There's a neoconservative document. I think it was first written in the late 90s, toward the end of the 90s, and it sets out the program that Wesley Clark just described. If Wesley Clark had time to be well-read, he would have cited that report. And it just shows the complete takeover of the United States by the neoconservatives, because the document that Wesley Clark saw on the general's desk from the Secretary of Defense is precisely that neoconservative program. So I think that when this started out, the intent was not to radicalize the Muslims. But the United States was surprised by two things. One, by the insurgencies that they couldn't control. So after all those years of being in Iraq, despite the fact that the Sunni and the Shia were spending most of the time fighting each other and not fighting the American troops, the United States was not able to pacify and occupy the country and had to give it up. And so that surprised them. The next thing that surprised them, the second thing that surprised Washington, was the Arab Spring. The initial Arab Spring, Tunisia and all this, was legitimate. It was real. And they were caught off guard, and they said, oh, my gosh, what can we do? And they said, oh, obviously, we'll co-opt it. We'll initiate our own Arab Springs, which is what they did in Libya, by importing the extreme Islamicists and aiding them against Gaddafi. And it's what they're doing in Syria, trying in Syria. In Syria, they can't be as successful because the Russians and Chinese caught on and blocked the no-fly zone that the United States and NATO had abused in Libya and turned into a full-scale air attack on Gaddafi's forces. So this time it gets blocked in the UN Security Council by China and Russia. So they unleashed, it's kind of like the Bay of Pigs. It couldn't succeed without the American Air Force, and that's what's happened to the so-called rebels in Syria. I mean, they're not rebels. They're imported jihadists, essentially terrorists, allied with al-Qaeda, who are opposed to secular Muslim governments, such as that of Assad. And they just simply want to overthrow any secular Muslim government and establish Shia law. So now the United States has decided, well, instead of fighting the terrorists, we'll use them. Because what this does, it radicalizes the whole area. And it leaves the countries in total turmoil, which is a big help to Israel. because there's essentially no government in Libya or Iraq. And the mass murders and bombings continue every day. The casualties in Iraq right now are as high on a weekly basis as they were during the American attempted occupation, because the Sunni and the Shia are still at each other's throats. So when you essentially leave these countries without an organized political entity, there can't be any political opposition to Israel's ambitions. And so this then serves Israel, which is, of course, one of the goals of the neoconservatives, and the radicalization using terrorists. That then is the way the United States can destabilize, as I said earlier, China and Russia. The real problem that Washington's world hegemony has faced has always been, how can we get these two big guys out of our way? And so that's what's happened. The original idea was we would set up puppets in the countries we conquered, and they would then do our bidding. But we found out that we couldn't conquer, we couldn't even occupy Baghdad. We certainly haven't been able to conquer Afghanistan.
And we would galvanize Iran, that is highly nationalistic, against us. Keep in mind, Iran is almost four times larger than Iraq, and has around 70, I think it was 70, 76 million people. So you're not dealing with anything that we could possibly win. Let me share a few final thoughts on this issue. And this is from Common Dreams from today. And it says, U.S. complicity in some of the most gruesome chemical weapon attacks revealed, Foreign Policy magazine provides new details in how CIA helps Saddam gas Iran. Quote, as the U.S. and its allies weigh the possibility of military intervention in Syria over the use of chemical weapons, new reporting by Foreign Policy reveals details of how the U.S. helped Iraq launch multiple chemical weapons attacks during the Iraq-Iran war. The magazine reports that formerly unnoticed documents in the National Archives, in addition to information obtained in interviews with former intelligence officials, quote, are tantamount to an official American admission of complicity in some of the most gruesome chemical weapons attacks ever launched. And then it goes on to talk about how we knew that Iran was going to be devastated by Iraq, but Iraq was being helped by Reagan, and also was it was in our interest politically to make sure that Iran didn't win. And because, after all, they had ousted the Shah, and who was enormously beneficial to the military-industrial complex. There was a time, by the way, for over a decade, where the number one purchasing agent of weapons around the world, outside the United States, was Iran through the Shah.
Right. They used the oil revenue.
Oil revenue. And so
they were recycled instead of going into treasuries like Saudi Arabia. They were recycled into weapons.
And that meant that the money came right back to the United States. So here are some additional things that I'm concerned with. First, go back to President Truman. You want to talk about weapons of mass destruction? Well, Hiroshima was worse. It was terrible. Nagasaki also. There's no justification for Nagasaki, none whatsoever. It was simply to test a new bomb to see how well it worked. Even after the Japanese surrendered, there was a 1,000-plane raid that killed over 100,000 people. No one was held accountable. There was Operation Meeting House, bombing of Tokyo in March 1945, and that was regarded as the single most destructive bombing raid in history. Again, it was unnecessary. Under President Eisenhower in the Korean War in 1951 and 2, the U.S. bombed so much there was nothing left to bomb, and so they simply bombed infrastructure against the Geneva Convention. And they bombed dams and electrical grids, and even the pilots commented on how cool it was to see water flooding villages. Then you had Johnson and JFK. They start the village bombing in South Vietnam in 1961 to 62. They start spraying Agent Orange in 1962, and that continued in 1971. They put neo-Nazi leaders and sympathizers in South American countries that led to the burst of totalitarian rulers in the 60s and beyond. And they also engaged in the enormous amount of death, over 2.5 million innocent civilians in Vietnam, over 500,000 deaths minimal in Cambodia in their secret wars and bombing. They used phosphorus. They used napalm, both of which were weapons of mass destruction. Nixon bombed napalm in Cambodia in 1973, 600,000 killed, according to the CIA's own figures. And that led to the domination of the Khmer Rouge, which killed another 2 to 2.5 million people. Jimmy Carter supported Indonesian dictatorship that led to the genocide of East Timorese in 1978. 90% of the regime's weapons were provided by the U.S. government. And the support of Somoza by Carter and his National Guard against the Sandinistas, which led to 40,000 people being killed. And then Reagan, now you worked in the Treasury and Undersecretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration. In my personal opinion, Ronald Reagan is a first-class war criminal, and if this were the end of World War II, he would have been hung. CIA files received by Foreign Policy show that in 1988, during the waning days of the Iraq-Iran War, Iran was gaining a strategic advantage, and CIA aided Saddam Hussein with the locations of Iranian troops with satellites for the launch of chemical weapons, including sarin gas and mustard gas. And Reagan's support of Nicaraguan death squads, which were responsible for over 200,000 people dying, had been condemned by the World Court. And Reagan's support for the South African government and the genocidal killings from 1980 to 1988 that the UN Commission estimated was 1.5 million lives. Now, when was last time anyone in the American media talked about 1.5 million Africans in South Africa losing their lives because of the genocide that Reagan supported and supported with the training of the troops and even weapons? Then you had Bush Sr. He used depleted uranium against Iraq in the first Gulf War, and Operation Just Cause to invade Panama. That caused a lot of destruction, tens of thousands of homes destroyed. Bill Clinton, his first act to show that he was a tough guy was to bomb Baghdad in what he called a self-defense due to an unproven assassination attempt on Bush Sr. And then in 1998, bombings of Afghanistan and the Sudan. And then the Balkan War and the invasion of Yugoslavia. Now, here's what we know from 60% of NATO targets directed by Clinton were against civilians. 33 hospitals, 344 schools, and 144 industrial plants. That had nothing to do with killing soldiers. That's infrastructure. And throughout Clinton, supported the Colombian military regime and its death squads, which has one of the worst human rights records in the world in the 1990s, and the support for the criminal Suharto in Indonesia. This man was a genocidal, Suharto was, and yet Clinton says, quote, he's our kind of guy. Well, Bill, I guess he was. And then you have Bush Jr., and then on goes Obama, depleted uraniums. Really bad. Now, mind you, Bush used them in the first Gulf. It was used in Kosovo, Bosnia, Serbia under Clinton. Bush Jr. used them in Afghanistan around Jalalabad and Fallujah. Why don't we talk about the napalm of white phosphorus? White phosphorus is against the law, and yet in Fallujah, over 1,500 civilians were killed there. And napalm was banned, and yet we've been using it. U.S. provided it to Greece in the Greek Civil War, to Franco, to go against the leftists, the liberals, the progressives, the communists. And it was used. It was also used in the Korean War, the Vietnam War. Israel used it in the Six-Day War and Indochina and Algerian Wars and India and Pakistan skirmishes and Turkey against Cyprus all used napalm. And the British used white phosphorus against the Kurds. And it's been used extensively. It was used in Fallujah. And yet, where is the outcry? You see, we should all be outraged by what happened. Absolutely. It was a crime against humanity to see these people killed, gassed. Who did it should be held accountable. But we don't know yet who did it. And yet we're going to rush off and go further into another military conflict on dubious grounds, just like weapons of mass destruction, just like the Gulf of Tonkin that got us into Vietnam. There was no Gulf of Tonkin. We have absolute, total, 100% proof that it was a false flag operation. And yet, no one has apologized. No one's gone to jail. No one's been held accountable. You had over 3 million dead people in that conflict. You have over a million dead people between Afghanistan civilians and in Iraq civilians, military, and no one's held accountable. Oh, we're going to go forward, not backwards. Should we condemn it? Yes. Why don't we then condemn our use of depleted uranium that is leaving the highest levels of miscarriage, stillbirth, and birth defects in the world? You have all countries in the world is right there in Iraq, and I have it on film because I did the film in Iraq. Showing the doctors in the hospitals that say, don't have any more kids because your kid could be born without a brain in his head, a cyclops, a baby with one eye in the middle of his head, all these deformities, all because of depleted uranium. And yet not a single embedded journalist has had the courage on NBC, CBS, CNN to go up and tell the truth. These are the unintended consequences of what we're doing with depleted uranium. We've made the place so toxic that it will be toxic for the next 2.5 billion years. So I just see rampant hypocrisy. I see us standing with self-such righteousness, especially the people who are absolutely the narcissists of the century, Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity, Mark Levin, and these people who never look at what it means to be a casualty, a victim, an innocent victim in any conflict. All they see is military might and go after them. Your final thoughts, please.
Well, good. Place to read up on everything you've said is Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick's book, The Untold History of the United States. It was published last year, and everything you said is detailed in that book. The only thing that I would say is that in my experience, and generally speaking, presidents are not always in control. Particularly if something is already happening when they come into office. The decisions that government make, it's sort of, you know, people kind of have the idea, well, the president made the decision. Well, usually they don't. Sometimes they don't even know about the decisions. some presidents were definitely bad. The decision to use the atomic bomb on Japan was Truman's. And Truman had a high school education. That was it. His Secretary of State was a ninth grade dropout. So you had people without any qualifications making the most enormous kinds of decisions. But usually what happens is some private interest group, they've bought the Congress, or they've contributed to the president's election. You come in office, you don't really know everything that's happened or why or what's going on. You struggle to get some control of the government. It's not easy because the interest groups influence the Senate that has to approve your appointees. They can put holes on them. They can block them. If a president succeeds in getting some of his own people in there and the establishment is opposed to them, then they get framed up and driven out of office. And this happened to Jimmy Carter. Remember, his budget director was framed up and driven out, and the establishment put their guy in. Carter's chief of staff was framed up and driven out, and the establishment put their guy in. It ended up happening to Reagan. His first national security advisor was framed up and driven out. They tried to put their guy in. Reagan said, no, I'm putting my guy in. He put his guy in again. They framed him up and drove him out. In the end, even Don Regan, who had been the loyal Treasury Secretary who took over as chief of staff, they got him out and put in an establishment figure. It's not always the president. And John Kennedy, who did catch on eventually to what was going on and saw the extreme risk and refused the air cover to the Bay of Pigs and refused the invasion of Cuba and refused the Northwoods Project, which was a 9/11 type
false flag. It was a false flag operation.
Yeah, it was a false. It was just a 9/11. And he refused that. And so he ends up getting assassinated because he's in the way. There's been any number of books by historians who studied it for 30 years, and they've proven beyond all doubt that Kennedy was murdered by the CIA and the Secret Service and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So it's not always the president.
Okay. I appreciate you giving this nuanced explanation. It helps us. It puts it in perspective. And
yeah, there's more power out there than we can control or hold accountable, even if you get a half-decent president.
I believe that. I believe that a president is selected before they're elected. And I don't believe we have the courage or strength of character to look at who are the real powers behind the president and members of Congress.
I just
don't believe we're able
right.
to do that. Well, Professor Roberts, thank you for coming on again and sharing your insights. It's certainly appreciated.
Well, no, Gary, you stay after him. It's important what you do.
Thank
and all
you.
The best to you.
Thank you, sir. Professor Paul Craig Roberts, and his book is How the Economy Was Lost, The War of the Worlds. He was Undersecretary of Treasury in the Reagan administration. He is one of the most outspoken, real progressive and independent thinkers in the world today. And his website is paulcraigroberts.org. I'm Gary Knoll. Just a few thoughts. I won't have a chance to do all of it today, but I'll get started and then we'll come back tomorrow on this. In an electoral system, according to Professor James Petras, run by and, of course, for a corporate oligarchy, let us be clear on that. And I believe this audience, you're all fully clear on that. What are you given? You're given deception and demagoguery. These are the elements. You entertain people that are average working class stiffs, but it's all for the benefit of the wealthy. Every U.S. president has engaged in one fashion or another in play acting to secure popular approval, to neutralize hostility and distract voters from the reactionary substance of their foreign and domestic policies. Every substantive policy is accompanied by a kind of a down-home folksy message to win public approval. This happened when President Jimmy Carter's revival of large-scale proxy wars in Afghanistan in the post-Vietnam period, Ronald Reagan's genocidal wars in Central and South America, and George Bush Sr.'s savaging of Iraq in the first Gulf War, and Bill Clinton's decimation of social welfare in the U.S. while bombing civilians in Yugoslavia and deregulating Wall Street, and George Bush Jr.'s invasion and partitioning of Iraq and Afghanistan, and the attempted coup in Venezuela, and the maximum taxing getting rid of those taxes for the rich, and Barack Obama's staggering bailout of the biggest Wall Street speculators, unprecedented launching of five consecutive wars and arrest and deportation of millions of immigrant workers, and each president has elaborated a style to ingratiate himself with the public. But don't forget this. They're always pursuing their reactionary agenda. In rhetoric and appearance and in public persona, it's for the U.S. presidents to present themselves as every man while committing political actions, including war crimes, worthy of prosecution. Each president, in his play acting, develops a style suitable to the times. They constantly strive to overcome the public suspicion and potential hostility to their overt and covert policies designed to build empire as domestic conditions deteriorate. However, not all play acting is the same. Each president's populist style in defense of oligarchical interest has this characteristic nuance. For example, the Carter gee whiz. Jimmy Carter was elected president at a time of the greatest mass anti-war upheaval in U.S. history. His campaign projected a soft-spoken, conciliatory president from humble roots, reaching out to the anti-war electorate and solemnly pledging to uphold human rights against domestic militarists and their overseas despotic allies. To that end, he appointed a liberal human rights advocate, Pat Darien, to the State Department and a veteran Cold War ideologue, Big Zig, he was called, Brzezinski, as a national security advisor and a foreign policy strategist. Now, duplicity reared its head immediately. Carter openly criticized the Somoza dictatorship in Nicaragua while privately telling the dictator to ignore the public criticisms and assuring him of continued U.S. support. And as the Sandinista revolution advanced towards victory, Carter convoked a meeting of Latin American leaders, urging them to join in a military joint intervention with the U.S. to save lives and to prevent the popular Nicaraguan revolution from taking power, dismantling the dictator's army. It soon became clear to the leaders of Latin America that Carter's mission was a thinly veiled humanitarian version of gunboat diplomacy, and they declined. When Carter realized that, without the fig leaf of Latin American participation, the U.S.-led invasion would arouse universal opposition, he abandoned the project, and the political climate would not support unilateral U.S. invasion so soon after the end of the Vietnam War. Reagan, geniality with a pinch of genocide. Up until the ascendancy of Barack Obama, President Ronald Reagan was acknowledged as the master con man. By virtue of his Hollywood acting experience, he was disciplined and hearkened back to the idea of, let us smash the unions. Let us show that as long as we wave the flag and that we are there for America, America first, that we can do just about anything. The knowing wink and clever two-liners were matched by an adaptation of morality tales of his cowboy films. Uncle Reagan, yes, friendly chats, would describe how he had stopped the communists and how he had protected Central and South America. Yet no one looked deep enough to see that it was all about CIA backing of the Mujahideen and what he did to facilitate to the CIA a secular civil structure, and Pentagon supported Israeli slaughter of Palestinian refugees in their camps in Lebanon and the mass genocide of scores of thousands of indigenous villagers in Guatemala. And when news reports seeped out about the mass graves of poor villagers in Guatemala, Reagan resorted to colloquial language right out of a Hollywood film to defend General Reyes Montt, saying, he's getting a bum rap. Really? You defend the brutal dictator of Guatemala? Yep, he did. That's how it worked. And Bush Sr., he had no charisma whatsoever. So following the breakup of the Soviet Union, the U.S. and Western Europe reconquered and pillaged and recolonized Eastern Europe. West Germany annexed East Germany, and a predatory gangster oligarchy in Russia seized over $1 trillion of public assets, impoverishing millions and laundering the illicit funds through elaborate banking operations on Wall Street in London and Tel Aviv. And President George Bush Sr. embraced the doctrine of unipolar world, free from rival superpower constraints and independent third world resistance. Poppy Bush believed the U.S. could impose its will by force anywhere and at any time without fear of retaliation. He believed he was heir to a new imperial order of free market and free elections and unrestrained plunder. The first war he would launch would be in the Middle East. The invasion, massive bombing, and destruction of Iraq. It was followed by an unprecedented expansion of NATO bases in Eastern Europe. The spread of neoliberal liberalism led to the naked pillage of public assets through the Latin American and Eastern Europe exchanges. The empire ruled the Muslim world through an arc of client dictators: Tunisia, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan. You know, he had the happy warrior persona, the invincible American president who had triumphed over the evil empire. And then you had Clinton. Bill Clinton, like Ronald Reagan, turned out to be a Wall Street populist. With his folksy Arkansas intonations, he preached messages of hope in black churches. Whenever he got in trouble, he'd rush off to a Baptist church and get down on his knees. And they'd say, "We forgive you, Bill." But all the while, he was diligently applying the free market lessons he had learned from his Wall Street mentors. Tooting the saxophone and oozing compassion, Clinton told the poor that he could feel their pain while inflicting misery on single mothers forced to leave their children and take minimum wage jobs in order to retain any public assistance. He joined hands with labor union bosses at Labor Day festivals while fast-tracking job-killing free trade treaties like NAFTA that devastated the American working class. Bill Clinton enthusiastically sent bombers over Belgrade and over Yugoslavian cities for several weeks, destroying its factories, hospitals, schools, power plants, radio and television stations, bridges, as well as the Chinese embassy in support of what if anyone had looked were the terrorists, the Kosovo Liberation Army, terrorist, in its separatist war against Belgrade. Clinton bombed civilians and their vital infrastructure, a war crime in the name of humanitarian intervention, to the ecstatic cheers of Western liberals and progressives and social democrats. They just couldn't get enough of this guy. Bush Sr., the Texas drawl. What can I say? His handlers and backers did their best to market this boy. His Ivy League credentials and New England background was replaced by a transparently phony Texas accent. Tinny, whiny sound bites reminiscent of his father's were replaced by a Texas rancher's homey drawl. His just folks' grammatical mistakes may have been mocked by the liberals, but they resonated deeply with fundamentalist Christians who could never have recognized the Phillips Exeter Academy, Yellow Skull and Bones Boy, as our commander-in-chief. And Barack Obama, the master of deceit. From the beginning of his presidential campaign, Obama demonstrated his proficiency at the master of the word. He spoke passionately against torture while consulting with the torturers. He condemned Wall Street speculators while appointing key Wall Street operatives as economic advisors. He promised a new deal in the Middle East, especially for Palestinians, and appointed a dual citizen, Israeli-U.S. Rahm Emanuel, who was the son of an Israeli high-big Irgun group, to be his most intimate presidential advisor. So he modulated his voice according to the audience, adopting a Baptist minister's cadence for the black audiences while assuming the professor's tone of an Ivy League lawyer for his Wall Street contributors. He hobnobbed with Hollywood celebrities and Silicon billionaires who bankrolled the fairy tale of his historic breakthrough. Indeed, Obama's supporters were enchanted by the phony rhetoric, the populist style, and the fake so-called authentic "I'm one of you." These are just some of the ways that our presidents have convinced us that we should overlook their policies and focus upon instead why we like them. I'm Gary Nall. Now let us go to our talkback segment, 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. In studio, we have Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. First, I want to personally thank you for your Monday night show. Far and away, the most comprehensive history of Iran and their relationship with the rest of the world that I've ever heard. And you certainly have gotten a lot of feedback from audience members. So, bravo. Very, very well done.
Thank you.
I want to mention one quick thing. We just finished up this retreat in Florida. And the responses from the people were overwhelming. Now, you know, when people come to these retreats, they're not coming all self-actualized. They're coming because they want to be healed. They want help. They're coming with their own agendas, if you will. And remember, I interview everybody. And I interviewed over 400 people for this one. And we had just a real dynamic group that came down there that were eager and open and ready to learn. Some of them, you know, had harder lessons than others, but overall the feedback has just been off the charts. We have people that have written in that what I receive from attending this retreat I will carry with me for the rest of my life. Another woman said, I'm working with my diet and staying in the moment. I have so much to learn and so much to do, and I haven't felt this way since I was a kid.
That's good. I'm on the road for another week before I come back to the city because I have to finish up some filming for an important documentary that I'm premiering just in under a month from now. And I was speaking with the station, and here's what we're going to do. I realized that about, oh, there must have been 300 or 400 people who wanted to come. We just didn't have room. I'm sorry, it was full. But I'm going to do it again. We are going to do another retreat as a fundraiser. And this was a fundraiser, and thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars went to WBAI and WPFW the first week of October and the second week of October. So for those of you who couldn't make that retreat, you will be able to make this one, hopefully, because you have enough time to plan for it. And again, there'll be wonderful classes in yoga, meditation, in healing energies, in cooking classes, gardening, homesteading, personal counseling by Luann, lectures throughout the day. I was doing 2 to 3 lectures a day at the retreat. And John Q with the wonderful water aerobics and with the wonderful art and healing classes. We had one of the best artists around who was there giving art classes. He's a professor of art, and he also oversees a large public gallery, and so he will be there. We'll have sprouting classes. So all this plus de-stressing, detoxing, and rejuvenation. Great food, great juices, and it's all for a fundraiser. It's all to help this non-commercial station. So if you'd like to attend the first and or second week, you can come for 1 or 2 weeks. In October, I'll be there. Give Luann a call. Luann, do you want to give your number, please?
Surely. It's 631-504-6198. Once again, 631-504-6198.
That's terrific. And I had people, I don't have time today, but tomorrow I will put up on the web, and we'll play it, some of the responses of people who just changed their whole life. Do you know two of the guys on the final day you had left, both had lost 16 pounds in 1 week.
Wow.
And the average weight loss was 7 pounds. But people came up and said, I finally know what I got to do. I know what steps I have to take. I know how to be consistent, being happy, healthy. And that's what's important, empowering people to live their life in a more constructive, healthy, and happy way. So it was a long week for those of us, and we had 20 volunteer staff from all over. We called in Jimmy from New York and Magdalena and all the other people who came, and Claire Adams and Cindy. All the people donated their time so selflessly. Now, mind you, these are all highly accomplished professional people in their field, and they all felt strongly enough to help people as a fundraiser for BAI to donate their time, as did I and you and others. So that's what it's about, helping people change their life, improve their life, rebalance their life, and start their life over. So if you want to join us, it'll be full. It'll absolutely be full. Everyone we do is full. I've done 400 of these or so, and they're always packed, and people change. It's in October, the first and second week. You can come for 1 or 2 weeks. The total cost is $2,000, and that is very inexpensive for everything you're getting. You couldn't go to another place in the world and get everything that you got at these retreats we've just given. But they're a successful way as a fundraiser. Why? Because the premium is your trip. So you can't not get it. You get the premium, right? So this is one thing that the stations can't screw up, since they seem to be able to screw everything up.
Easy.
I know. We'll knock that down. Mm-hmm. But this one, they can come and get it and enjoy. So give a call to Luann if you want to join us, and she's the one who will talk with you, and we'll all see you the first and second week of October. Luann, give your number again.
Sure, 631-504-6198. 631-504-6198. Gary, I already have a dozen people that signed up that said, oh my God, if he ever has this again, let me know. We even had some people, because we had so many the last time, some people opted to wait for the next retreat, so they're automatically in. So if you want to come on down, give me a call. This is the time.
Great. Well, we're looking forward to it. Thank you, Luann.
Okay.
And thank all of you. This was a special edition of the program today, because I just feel I can see what's happening, and it's unnerving to know that the American public is being played, and the American media is complicit. and that we're not being told the truth. You would have thought that after the wars of that we've had in Iraq and Afghanistan, what with the complete disaster in Libya, that we would have learned some lesson, but evidently we have not, and that's why I felt it necessary to give it some sense of pause before we run off and do something stupid. Let's at least know the facts. Thank you for listening. Now let's say hello to Yutrice Lee. Hi, Yutrice.
Hello, Gary. And is Luann still with us or no? Well, hello, Luann.
Hi, I'm here.
Oh, hello to you too. Well, today, of course, it is open forum on Lead Stories, and the listeners take the conversation wherever they want it to go.
Great. Well, we're going to be listening. I'm going to be out filming, so we look forward to hearing Yutrice Lee right now.